Welcome to Ben Navarez Podcast with your host, Ben Navarez.
Howdy, hi, and welcome back to the podcast. This is your host, of course, as always, Ben, or Ben Thinking. So thank you guys for coming on and listening and joining us today. We have quite a hell of a guest today who has worked with a large set of really cool individuals in his life, is what it seems like. I'm sure that there's been a lot more than he will elaborate on. But today we have Eric Degatti on. And so, Eric, thank you for coming on, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Eric, how did you get into the health and fitness space? And then I guess specifically inside of coaching.
So health and fitness was a couple different things. I always say there was three main drivers. One was I had some pretty significant back pain, and I was too young to be having that kind of significant back pain, but it was a combination of not knowing what to do and just plain stubbornness. I was sleeping on the floor. I was in my late teens, early 20s, sleeping on the floor for months on end. Finally, my mother said, you got to do something. So I go to a doctor. I just went to the general doctor. I didn't know what to do at that point. And he made me wait in the waiting room for a couple hours, only to go in another room and sit on tissue paper and wait for another hour for him to look at my back and go, could be anything. And I said, really? I waited this whole time for that? And so I said, screw this. And I just went to the gym and I just looked up everything that said back on it. And I just did it. And by shit luck, I actually got better. So I'm like, well, if I'm investing the time here, I want to learn more about this. And that kind of was one of the drivers. Then I thought about, that situation. I thought about, my grandmother who had multiple knee replacements and countless knee surgeries that completely debilitated her. She was a super active person, but not active like working out person, but loved to travel, do all these things. But she's not somebody that should have a knee replacement. She ran a gift shop. She shouldn't be somebody that should have that many orthopedic issues. And because she never got the right care, if she probably went to somebody like me, if I got her now, she wouldn't have had a single knee surgery because there's no need for it for a lot of things she had. And so that was kind of me wanting to be the Robin Hood to save those people from that fate, and which can directly impact their lives. And then when I started to get into training, I didn't know if there was going to be a career in it. And then once I did, I saw there was such a low barrier for entry and even more so, such low expectations for what people were looking and expecting out of the experience. And so I realized if I just am a little bit better than everybody else, if I put a little bit of effort into this, I quickly became the most booked trainer in the gym within a couple months, and then kind of grew from there.
Cool, man. I mean, I think that last piece I'm going to focus on the most. I think like those last, the first two items, I think a lot of people in the health and fitness space got into it because of the problem within themselves that they wanted to kind of go through or got to see somebody else that they wanted to help. So I think very relatable and super awesome. I think the last one has a huge point of value. The unfortunate reality that I see is that thing of such low expectations and such a low standard of entry that it is one of the most frustrating things for me inside of this space. When I first started to learn, I looked around, I was like, man, like it seems like anybody can be a trainer. And especially now with social media, you just write in your, write in your bio, personal trainer. And it seems like you have this access. And I think that the way that education is around our field, I think there's a really cool opportunity for, I understand that having maybe a governing body isn't always the best. We have the NSCA, we have all these other like huge companies that kind of help with the education piece, but there is such a low standard and it seems like it was, you're just a personal trainer again. I was like, no. If I do a little bit more, if I bring a little bit more care or analysis to what we're doing, it sets you apart immensely. It's such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's how it's viewed on multiple levels. At the end user, you got to realize that they're facing an entire generation of fitness influencers. This wasn't a thing that was around when I started 25 years ago, but now I have people who are giving out and dispensing fitness advice who have never actually trained another human being. and they're, and people are going to them as if they're experts just because they kind of lucked out and picked the right parents and maybe take steroids along the way and look really good on an Instagram post. And now they think that they have some sort of knowledge. It's kind of like, you know, they, as the expression goes, they were born on third base and they think they hit a triple. And so, you know, they shouldn't be the people that you're going to for your fitness advice. And then even within the industry, I think we don't realize, since it's such a young industry as a whole, we don't realize the impact we can have on a much larger scale.
What is that impact? I'm going to ask you.
I mean, I always talk about it as the fork in the road. And so like, if you get somebody at the right point, and especially the population that I'm kind of pivoting to work a little bit more with recently, is that we know that 50% of all adults, if not more, are dealing with some sort of musculoskeletal injury, right? And they're dealing with some sort of pain. The low back pain is the second leading cause for people calling in out sick to work. Like you can't go to a dinner party, and I'm sure, you know, you go to holiday parties now and everybody's going to get you to tell you their story, their aching knee, their back, their shoulder, whatever it is. Can you give me a stretch for it, an exercise for it? And so because of that, those people, when they seek help, what is their options, right? Their options are, well, they're going to go to a doctor because that's seen as the authority in this space. And the doctor basically has three options. One is, I'm going to send you for physical therapy. Now, if you luck out and land on the right mark, and you get a really good PT, great, problem solved, on with your life. If you don't, and unfortunately, that's a service that is slipping dramatically because of billing situations, because it's become a lot of smaller places have been bought out by big corporate centers, and it becomes these mills. And you walk in and you notice, hey, I'm getting the same treatment as everybody else in the room. Everybody's getting heat stim, ultrasound, the same four exercises, and sent on their way, regardless of what they have or who they are. So now they go to that. They're probably not going to get results. And now what's the second option? Well, I can give you drugs, and that's a really scary situation, right? Based on where we're at with opiates and so forth, or bring it to surgery. And the stats aren't really great on that either. And then think about on a larger scale, holistically, what that does to the individual. They're a failed patient. They're broken. They're feeling old and kind of washed up and all those things. And so where if they just kind of came, kind of like the story I said with my grandma, like if they just came at that fork in the road and we bumped them in the right direction, and maybe Ben, you gave them a little more resilience. And so they were able to avoid that surgery. They were able to avoid that failure. And now all of a sudden, it's a completely different life that you've created. Now, if you do that on an individual level, you've still done a ton. If you can start doing that on a larger scale level, well, now you're changing communities. You're changing healthcare, basically.
That's good. A lot of very valuable points. I think that as professionals in our field, we get to have a lot of influence, right? A PT, a physical therapist, is restricted pretty severely with their, you know, with insurance, versus if I get a client that comes in, I can work within my scope and I can do quite a lot with being in a gym. I can work somebody all the way to the point of rehab, and then we incorporate some prehab exercises that we're going to maintain throughout the life of that client for whatever issues we may have. And then we can go all the way into some hypertrophy strength training, and then depending on the athlete, some power stuff. But ultimately, somebody who's 60 years old, them coming to me and having a little bit more bone or coming away from me with a little bit more bone density and being able to squat fully is going to change the rest of their lives. And I think that we have that opportunity in this field, which I absolutely love.
Yeah. And we're dispensing the most powerful drug in the entire world. There is not a single drug on the market that can even compare to the impact that movement and exercise has. It just doesn't. If you look at the impact of and the correlations of things like your VO2 max and your cardiovascular strength as a predictor of mortality, your grip strength, the number of push-ups you can do, all of these, your mobility and movement competency, all of those things have incredibly strong correlations with your longevity. And not only longevity, but also your health span of how well those years are going to be lived. And that is a significant impact that we can have because we have at our disposal the most powerful drug in the world if we know how to dispense it correctly.
I saw that you are, I think it may be functional movement systems kind of guy. What are some governing bodies that you've found a lot of value in getting education from?
So I hooked up with Gray Cook and Lee Burton early on in the stages of FMS. This was back in the late, this was early 2000s. And they were just kind of a budding company at the time. I was at the first ever certification they had in our area. And through that, got built a relationship and became a lead instructor for them, as I have been for the last, oh man, maybe 16, 17 years teaching it around the world. Through there, there's a lot of other people that I've got to network with within our field who are doing some really good things, depending on who your target audience is and what you're really looking to gain as far as a skill set, and being able to add on to those types of things. Now, in addition to that, you know, my partner and I, Mike Perry, started a company called Principles of Program Design, where we kind of take all those things and not look at teaching you methods like an FMS or kettlebells or something like that, and then teach how to incorporate that entire thing into a system so you can make judgments of this is when I want to use this tool, this is when I want to use this tool, based on a set of principles and a systematic kind of checklist.
I like that checklist. That's something that I'm interested in learning. How do you guys select your, I guess, even though a conversation that I would like to get, like I would like to learn about inside this program, but since we're here, how do you select your exercises?
Okay. So
your tools.
Okay. So that's two different questions there, Ben. So let's first go on the macro in terms of how do I decide which tools I'm going to use and when, right? Cause if you have that, is the key thing is to find out as much about three main things I say I need to really write a good program to decide which tools are going to be best for the situation. First is your past. What has happened up until this point? What's your training history? What's your medical history? What's your injury history? What have you had success with? What have you had failures with? I need to know all of that. Okay. That's the first thing. The second thing is your present. That's the value of a good assessment and evaluation process to look at what's your movement competency, what's your fitness level, what's your physical capacities, and kind of set baselines there and see if there's any specific limitations within those. And then most importantly, I need to know your future. What is the environment you need to go into? What are the things that you're going to have to face in your everyday life, whether it's a sport, whether it's your occupation, whether it's just part of your day? What are the things that you have to, environments you need to do? What are some of the things you like to accomplish? Now, with all that information, then I could put together a pretty good program. Now, when it comes down to exercise selection, what's interesting is when we teach is that exercise selection, like we don't get to, like if we teach our live course, we don't even get to exercise selection till like 5 hours in. Because there's so many other decisions that have to get made before we even get there. And a lot of times when you get to exercise selection within, with a few exceptions, we could give you six different answers and they're all right. Right. And so it's not as significant as most people point out, as most people would like it to be, because there are those other options. You know, I just had this discussion with a client this morning in explaining exercise selection. And this is the way I explain it to the end user. Is I use this analogy of the Cheesecake Factory, right? You ever been to the Cheesecake Factory, right? What's the one thing that sticks out in your mind about the Cheesecake Factory? Everybody says the same thing. What's the one thing you remember?
The menu.
The menu is ridiculous, right? It takes us 45 minutes to order appetizers because there's 7,000 things to choose from. Well, here's how I think about exercise. Like you and I could probably go for the next week, and if we just kept rattling off exercises and derivatives and progressions and regressions, we could come up with thousands of exercises. So which one do I choose? If I only get to choose really 6, 8, 12 exercises that are going to make it to your program, how do I audition those, so to speak? Well, if I went into Cheesecake Factory and then I walk in and I have a gluten intolerance, I have a dairy intolerance, I don't eat red meat, I can't have sugar. Well, that cuts that menu down pretty significantly. Then now it's a little bit easier to make choices. Well, the same thing happens when you walk in my door and I'm going to pick an exercise program, but you can't touch your toes. Okay, well, that's going to give me a whole set of exercises that we're not going to do. We're probably not going to have you do kettlebell swings or deadlifts or those types of things. Or you don't have ankle mobility, or you have really poor balance, or you don't breathe well. Okay, well, that's going to now start trimming down that list, and it gets a little bit easier to make the selection. And then even when I do make the selection, like I said, I may boil it down to three or four choices. You may pick one, I may pick a different one, and they'll both work, right? And but that's how we kind of go about the exercise selection process. And the once you get to that point, do I need to change it a whole lot? Well, as you eliminate these limitations simultaneously, and all of a sudden now you can touch your toes fine, well, now it opens up more of the menu. And then once you get to a point where you've eliminated all the limitations, if you can, well, then now you have a full menu to choose from. And now it's just a matter of making it specific to your goal, make it specific to your environment, and kind of make it specific as to what the client wants or likes without going overboard like most people do of just kind of changing it up every single day with still having some plan and some systematic approach to it.
You verbalized that so well. I think that obviously you've been doing this for a long time, but the way that I've always thought about it is like I have a limited access and I'm trying to ultimately increase that access. And so I think the analogy is beautiful. Everybody knows Cheesecake Factory. Everybody has a hard time ordering all a bunch of stuff. So I think it was very, very well verbalized. And I think something that maybe some coaches don't necessarily have that same method of thought, which is something that, you know, they can learn from. I think it's definitely very high value. What is the FMS training style? And then like, I think Hip Square came out of FMS, right? I think that was like, maybe I'm wrong, but like a 90-90 kind of, you can elaborate a little more. What are some movements that come out of FMS that you really enjoy?
Okay. So here's the big thing. And it's, I spend the first half hour of, and then revisit it multiple times when I teach an FMS course, of explaining everybody not what it is, but this is what it's not, all right? And because most of the people, if you were to go on any social media and you see the people who bash it, almost every time, and Mike and I actually did this research when we were preparing all the content for the course, is we went and looked up all the haters and everybody that bashed it. And most of the people either A, never even took the course, or B, were blaming it for something that it was never supposed to do, you know, in terms of preventing injuries. We never said it prevented injuries, right? We showed that there's some pretty significant data sets that show there's a pretty good correlation between people who don't move well and people who get injured, right? But that's one of multiple factors. Other things is that it's not about just assigning magical corrective exercises. All it is basically is looking at a basic set of movement competencies to say everything you do in the world can be basically boiled down into some simple movement patterns. And this is not something that FMS created. This is something people like Shirley Sarman have been using in the physical therapy world for a while to say, let's take our movements and boil it down into some simple categorical buckets. And then from there, say, how do we look objectively, as objective as you can within a screen that we want to be able to get done in about 10 minutes and say, look at a movement. And if you and I were to look at a movement, and I'll do, you know, I'll put a movement up on the screen and say, okay, who here in the room is cool with that? Meaning you're good, that I don't have any apprehension about loading that, about having that person do a bunch of volume within that pattern. You feel comfortable with it. If you say no, something doesn't look right there, then the next question is, does this person have pain when they do it? Yes or no, that's going to drive our decisions. If you look at it, they have no pain, and it's nothing significant that jumps out at you and says, I shouldn't do this, well, then you can load it and train it. If you see something doesn't kind of look right, smell right, then we probably don't want to load it or put a bunch of volume into it. And then maybe we'll look and see if we have some solutions to try to correct that so it no longer looks like that. And if it's pain, let's get them to somebody who can actually treat that pain. That's all the system is, right? And that's as simple as I can make it. Just give you an 8-hour course in about 2 minutes. Now, yeah. From there, the corrections, this is the other thing. We don't really care what you do, right? So if you find that someone has a poor leg raise or poor shoulder mobility, I don't care whether you use, if you're a therapist and you're going to use Grassen technique, ART, or mobilizations, or if you're a Pilates instructor, if you're going to use a kettlebell, if you're going to use FRC, I really don't care how you fix it. We're just going to have a common language of a scoring system to say either that's cool or that's not cool. And we'll at least agree on that as a minimum. It's not an optimum, and it's not a predictor. I'm not saying if you can do this well, you're going to go and be in the NFL. All it does is just say, this is looking for any limitations that may come up or potential risk factors that may be things I want to consider. Like, if you can't hinge your hips, well, I probably shouldn't load you into a deadlift. Could you still deadlift? Yes. but we're doing it with your fingers crossed, right? Are there people that, you know, smoke and drink and live into their 90s? Yes, but it's probably not the greatest prescription for longevity. So we want to look at in trying to mitigate risk as much as possible, and it helps drive some of those exercise decisions. In terms of specific movements, like I said, we don't have a vested interest. We share some of the things that we find work really well, depending on the certain patterns. But like a 90-90 position, we didn't make that up. You know, I always joke when I teach is I'll say, okay, I need to do a quick survey. In the room, do we have anybody that's an ancient Greek? And everybody looks at you. I'm like, okay, well, good, because they created the medicine ball that we're doing, you know, calisthenics and stuff thousands of years ago. I said, do we have any yogis that are like 2,000 years or older? Okay, well, if you're not one of those, you really didn't invent shit, because we're stealing from all of them. And 90-90 position is something that's been part of yoga for thousands of years. We're just taking it and repackaging it into whatever we find that, hey, this helps fix that problem really well most of the time.
I like it. I need to get myself – I've been wanting to do an FMS certification for a while now. But again, I just – because there's so much education out in our space. It's all these independent individuals. And there's a lot of like, hey, this is really good, and hey, this is really bad. Like it's almost paralyzing, and it's hard to make the decision to end up deciding, okay, like this is, yeah, I'm going to spend some good money on this form of education. And I think that for some, especially newer coaches, it's hard to spend that kind of money on a certification and then realize afterwards, man, I really didn't enjoy that.
Yeah. And I was that guy in the late 90s. I was that guy. And this is, you know, free social media or any of that stuff. If you sent a flyer to my house, I signed up for your course and I took them all. And there was some really crappy ones in there. And then there were some ones that were life-changing. And I think the biggest thing I could give as advice to those younger coaches, because we mentor those types of people, is to say, okay, pick somebody who's done what you want to do. All right. So if you look at the end result, what would you like to do? And you look and say, well, I would love to be able to do what an Eric Cressy or Mike Boyle or Alan Cosgrove, or you go down the list and then trace the steps. Like they're going to give you the breadcrumb trail to tell you where you need to go. And so if you look and say, well, I'm vetting something like an FMS and say, okay, well, I look and see, well, that's something that, you know, Coach Boyle's been using within his facilities and Alan Cosgrove uses. So like the people that I trust and I want to be like, if they use it, it's probably a good idea that I learn it too. Now they each have different ways in which they utilize it. And that's kind of the art of it. And that's what you learn through experience and trial and error, be in the trenches. But in terms of the breadcrumb trail, is I think that's the first place to start, is find someone who's done what you want to do and then look at what they've done. And pay attention to what they say and what they're paying attention to. And that's where I'm going to go.
One of the biggest ones is the CSCS. Was that something that you had your eyes on and then ended up moving forward to getting, or not at all?
You know, it's one of those things. It's kind of like with the NSCA content. For me at the time, it was like, it's a good thing to have on your resume as a ticket to get your foot in the door. But in terms of practical application, I didn't find it as useful. But that's also the settings that I was in. Now, if I was going to go be full-time working with a team, there's going to probably be a little bit more practicality to it. Most of the times when I'm working with teams, I'm working as a consultant. I'm not the person who's their sole strength coach who has to do a lot of the behind the scenes stuff that I didn't have to deal with. I'd show up, I'd do my thing and my part. But I didn't have to do a lot of the other things that a traditional strength and conditioning role would involve.
How did you get to the point of being that consultant for these teams?
So it wasn't like I started off and said, you know, I'm going to work with, you know, the Giants one day, or I'm going to go consult. So some of it was through going out and teaching with FMS that I got to do workshops for four different NFL teams, got to do, and then in the NHL, you know, did the Major League Combine, like those sorts of things helped build some of those relationships. That was certainly a driving force. And then some of it was through situations where, you know, you start training an individual and that individual then goes to this school and then that school is interested and they want to find out more about it. And well, if we're lucky enough that they get to the professional ranks and they want to find out, hey, what is it that you've been doing? And I've been working with this guy, you should really talk to him. That's kind of how those relationships got built. But then once you get in the door, you got to realize that there's a lot of people knocking on that door. You know, I always joke about when I was in school, there was three disciplines that you could go into with under the umbrella of exercise science. There was exercise physiology, which is what I did. There was athletic training, and there was teacher certification, if you want to go be a phys ed teacher. And when we have these classes, I remember a class of careers in fitness and in the industry and careers in exercise science. And I remember every athletic training student and every ex-phys student was like, yeah, I'm going to work with the Giants. I'm going to work with the Knicks. I'm going to work. And I'm like, no, you're not, buddy. You understand the head trainers at those places have been there 20, 30 years. And you know how many resumes have stacked up in front of yours that are way more qualified than you. And so with that, you really have to bring something unique to the door, unless you have some really incredible, you know, hooks that are going to get you to jump ahead of that line. And so you have to provide incredible value because everybody's coming at them with a solution. And of course, as soon as their star player gets hurt, or as soon as everybody thinks they have the solution without knowing or understanding the entire process. And so there's a lot of moving parts, and it's not just go in and I have skills. Even if you're the greatest person in the world at solving hamstring problems, they may not need or want you to come in because there's a lot of other things at play that you can't even wrap your head around looking from the outside in.
Are those things as simple as like personality things, or are those like internal like politics and bureaucracies?
Both. But the number one thing, and I don't care if you're trying to work with an NFL team or players, or you're trying to work with executives in their 40s, is your ability to connect, create rapport and trust is the number one thing, right? Even when I started working with the Giants, as we came in, we were outside consultants, and I had players who I ended up becoming very, very close with, like guys that invited me to their wedding, who said, when you first came in, I didn't trust you. I thought you were going to get me in trouble. I thought you were going to tell the team everything that was wrong with me. And I had to explain to them, no, look, I'm here to extend your career. The more guys that stay in the field, the better that I look, the better we do, and the more they keep bringing me back. That's the only reason I'm here, right? And I don't necessarily get paid differently whether you do or whether you don't, but it's in everybody's best interest if you do. And so I had to build up the trust that they were going to say, because look, they're giving me the keys to a couple $1 million asset, and there needs to be a lot of trust there. And so you have to be able to be humble to say that, you know, sometimes I may do some things that create a result that I can't go shouting from the mountaintops and try to take the credit for it, that I have to understand that that was my job, and that I'm not going to be the one running to Instagram to tell everybody that I fixed this guy's hamstring, or I'm the one who got him back on the field, or let me show you all, you know, pictures of me with all these people, and like I was responsible for the results. You understand, you're just a piece of a bigger puzzle. No matter how involved you are, there's a lot of moving parts when you get to that level.
How many different individuals are looking at this one athlete? I mean, I know from, I asked that question with a little bit of background, but I want you to elaborate a little bit more, especially at that elite level.
Okay. So you have, in terms of just the team itself, regardless of the sport, you have the personnel department, which is involved in scouting, and their entire job is to replace you with somebody better. Right. So you have to continually be better. As a player once told me that, you know what they do in this league? They love you until they don't effing love you anymore. Right. And that's essentially what they're looking. If there's a younger, cheaper version of you, you're gone. Okay. So you have to deal with that stress every day. Then you have your coaching staffs that you have to please so you can get on the field and you can get opportunities so you can express your skill. So you have to handle that. Then you have a strength and conditioning and development staff that you have to buy into their program to a certain extent. And then sometimes that program's better than others. Sometimes that program's more suited for you than others. Then you have a medical and training staff that you have to be able to trust that's looking out for your health, but also sometimes they're also looking for a reason to get rid of you. If they can find something faulty on an MRI or an X-ray. I had a guy tell me once, if I go in that training room, they're going to put me in an MRI tube. And my agent told me that's 10 grand off my next contract instantly. So if there's something we can do to keep me out of that tube, I'm in, right? Yeah. So that's just inside. Now you go outside, you have family, you have all the people that are pulling at you from a business aspect that are trying to get involved with you. You have outside. So let's say most of these athletes don't live where they play. So now they have to go home and they have to find resources there. Do those resources mesh with what the team is providing, or is it going to contradict and create a problem there? And then they have to have all those resources in line that make sure they're the right fit. Cause everybody loves to line up and train that the cool names to put the cool jerseys on a wall and the cool social media posts, but that doesn't mean you're ready to actually handle what those athletes need and understand that. So you have all those aspects. Then you have their agent getting involved and how much this is going to make decisions based on where they're at in terms of their contract. There's a lot of moving parts right there that you have to try to manage and appease and not piss any of them off, because any one of them will get you pulled off of that team instantly.
That's a lot of hats to wear and a lot of people to balance.
Yeah, absolutely. And they don't always mesh, because there's sometimes it's because of egos, and sometimes it's because they're just trying to save their job. And like, you know, you're most times, unless you're in unique situations, most times it's a performance-based thing, and you could lose your job that hasn't, even though you did a tremendous job. There was, you know, teams that I've consulted with that we had the least amount of injuries in our division 1 year, and then the most amount of injuries another year. You know what we did different in our training program? Absolutely nothing. So everybody that calls in and says, "Oh, fire the training staff," you understand? It's the same program that got us to win the division had the least amount of injuries. It's the personnel. We always say. I actually have a post that I'm doing later today, and it talks about how value is an extraction game, meaning that a teacher in school teaches the same lesson to the entire classroom of maybe 30 kids. Some kids get A pluses, some kids get Fs, teaching the same exact lesson. Well, the program is a matter of who you have bought into it. How much, you know, there's been times where strength coaches have been fired because of injuries when none of the guys who were injured actually even worked with that strength coach. But he was an easy fall guy because somebody needed to pay for the injuries. So there's a lot of things that are even outside of your control, and you just have to understand and appreciate that.
Do you have a system, or are you just naturally, I think you have to be natural akin to it, but understanding a language and then the culture within that specific team, because every team that you meet with is going to be different. Even if you go a little bit more micro, you can even say within specific positions, you're going to have different language, different culture. How do you, is there a method to understanding how these people work? Like, are you interviewing specific people that are higher up that have this specific language that ends up getting disseminated down the chain? Or are you talking directly to the athlete?
It depends on what your role is and what situations you have available to you. And what kind of access you have. In my case, I did it on both ends. You know, I had to obviously impress the people who were going to make the decisions and allow me in the door and access to their athletes. I had to impress them enough that they had the trust in me to get in. And then once I got in, I had to get the individual athletes' trust that they'll get in. And then to get the support, what I did is I also tried to get things like the position coaches to get them on board. So when those guys would come in at lunchtime and work out, I just spark up conversation and just make small talk and say, "Coach, if you could have one more thing, if your athletes in your group could do one thing better, what would it be? Like, if I could help you, what would be the biggest thing I could help your athletes be able to do?" And like, you know, no, a lot of times I say, "No, nobody's ever asked me that." And that's really, it's no different. Again, depending on any of the populations, is I tell whether it's a young athlete, or if it's somebody just looking to get fit at a later age, I say, if I had a magic wand, which I don't because it would make our lives a lot easier, but if I did, and I could give you this one thing that would give you instantly the ability to do what you wanted to do at the level you wanted to do it, what would that thing be? And it, you know, creates people to have some pause. And that's what I'll say. I'll say to a linebackers coach, say, "Coach, what does your unit struggle with physically? Is there anything maybe that I could pitch in and help with?" Or even coordinating with a performance director who's tracking metrics like, you know, GPS and things like that, and sit down and say, "Hey, you know, if you got a couple of minutes, I'd like to compare some notes of what I'm finding and what you're finding, and let's see if there's any anomalies that match up." And they say, "Yeah, is there anything that stands out?" And like, "Well, yeah, this guy, he's significantly slower cutting to his left than he is on his right. And I'll look up and sometimes I'll say, well, nothing on my end shows why he would do that. So I wish I could help you, but I can't. But then other times it's like, well, that kind of makes sense. His right ankle mobility is not anywhere where his left ankle mobility is. And so that's something we're going to work on. So let's do this. Let me work on that for a couple of weeks. And I want you to check it again. And let's see if we move the needle. Let's see if that was the parking brake that was holding them back. And then now we're creating some cross communications where some really cool things start to happen, where you're kind of cross-pollinating thoughts across departments and across different levels. And that's where the magic really happens. Now, it takes, again, a lot of trust building to get to that point, because everybody's trying to defend their turf, because if something goes wrong and shit hits the fan and somebody's got to go, it's a lot better if it's you than me.
Yeah, what a complex environment. But also, like, that's the environment that I think is seen amongst sports medicine, and then you got the strength and conditioning folk, then you have the business side of things, I mean, your administration, like, you have all these different individuals that are playing into this one person. And I like the performance side of it. Obviously, it's something that I really enjoy. But I like that it is at the end of the day, a team effort built around a team, right? It's layered, and it's kind of, I think it's pretty neat, but difficult to do and do well.
It's funny. I just had a lengthy conversation with a guy I've become friends with, who's a very high level PT here in New York, works with a lot of top professional athletes, and even as well as one of the pro leagues he's a consultant for. And, you know, he said, I had interviewed him, and he said, you know, there was a question that you asked me that has been stinging, that's kind of ringing in my head ever since you asked me it a couple months ago. He said, what's different in your approach for a quote unquote, for lack of a better term, regular person versus a professional athlete? And he said, I've really been thinking about it. And he said, I don't know if there is one. And I said, yeah, it really isn't. I tell everybody what's the difference if I have an NFL player or someone coming in looking to lose 10 pounds who's in their 50s, is my approach is going to be the same. My application is going to be different because they have different demands. That future part of it is very different for the one individual versus the other. But other than that, the process is going to be the same. I have a checklist of things. Do you at least have these minimums that you've met? And whether you're one or the other, if you can't touch your toes, you can't touch your toes. That's a human fundamental thing that you should be able to do, right? And there's some simple human fundamental things that you should be able to do. You should be able to breathe well. You should be able to do all these things. And so if we don't have those things in order, it doesn't matter who you are, and then you check those boxes first. Then as we get further down the line, and unfortunately most people skip those steps and go right ahead to the cool stuff that's sexy for Twitter or Instagram, they skip those big rocks and they go right to the granular stuff. And that's the biggest mistake people make, because the approach, as I said, is still the same. It's just the application that changes.
Dealing with a more GP or gen population client, or a normal, to use your verbiage, more of a normal athlete or client, how do you create buy-in with the understanding that this may take some time, with we're learning the foundation and then we're going to move forward? And the reason I ask is because I think traditionally it's pretty simple. But there are times, and like I had a client recently who is a professional model, like runway model, does the fashion week, does the whole thing, and was looking for a lot of progress very quickly. And we couldn't squat well. We had terrible overhead mobility. We couldn't balance for 60 seconds on a single leg. And I was like, we can get to those things, but we need to accomplish these things first, so that whenever we get to those items, you're much more equipped and I feel more comfortable giving you those days to train on your days off alone, where I'm not, you know, there. I feel just safe and comfortable with you doing that point. But it seemed oddly difficult for this specific client. But then whenever we have clients like that, how do you create some more trust in those times to help you have that buy-in?
Dan John has a great line. He says, remember to keep the goal, and we have to understand, as much as we understand and appreciate the importance of all the things that you mentioned, all those attributes, is that if this person makes their living by being able to walk 60 feet and turn around and walk back, like, those things don't have as much importance to them. Or it doesn't mean that they're not important. It means that I have to understand that depending on the timeline, I may or may not be able to get all the things I want to get, because I may have to make some sacrifices and say, I'm going to have to adjust this program so they can still look good, because that's what they get paid for. They can still look good. And my job is just don't make them worse. If I can do that and say, okay, when's the next show you have to look great for? Okay, if that's a month away, I'm never going to be able to fix all the things you talked about and do that at the same time. It's just going to be, and if something's got to give, it's not that. They don't get paid to balance. They don't get paid to squat. They get paid to walk and look good. So with that is I got to make sure that you can do that at the very least and do it really, really well. And as much as the other stuff I could sneak in, great. Now, if you say to me that show, the next show after that is not for another 6 months, well, then that's where I have a little bit more freedom that I can start to apply those things. But let's not lose sight of the goal of why they came here. And that happens a lot with, and we talk about like what kind of data you collect and so forth, that the at the end of the day, the results are what matter. And if someone comes in and says, I want to lose inches off my waist and I want to look better in a bathing suit, and a month later, you're telling them how great it is that their bench press is up and their FMS score is up and their vertical jump is up, but their waistline hasn't moved. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to go to somebody who's going to give it to me. Cause you're obviously not the person. Those things are cool, but that doesn't help me. That's not what I came here for.
That's interesting. I like that perspective. Keep the goal, the goal. I think that I can definitely get caught up in my own goal. And I think the way that, you know, if I go to the veterinarian and my dog's not doing well, and they tell me I need, you know, we need to get these X medications and have this surgery, I'm not in a place of professionalism to say, or like that, you know, this is my expertise. It's just, okay, this person knows this thing better than I do. Let me step off a little bit, give them some trust, and then let them, if it's not going to be the right fit, it's not going to be the right fit, and I'll find that out. My dog doesn't do well. But if I'm making the progress in all these other directions and this person is telling me, hey, like that's part of the game. It's just, I ultimately the concept of the customer's not always right is part of my thought process. And I understand that they have specific goals, but I think in order to get to those goals with the knowledge that we have, it should be done in an XYZ state. Given that we have the time for it, right? It is a good stipulation. If I have a show in a month and I need to get lean or I need to get whatever in a month, then well, that's my timeline. But if my timeline is this is how I live, I do gigs on the weekends, I do gigs, Hooters this month, and then next month we're doing this other job, and it's just part of the way we live. At what point do I sacrifice all those other items and then only focus on trying to look good all the time?
I think it was Lane Norton said that there is no right decisions. There's just trade-offs, right? And as long as you take the role first and foremost as an educator to say, look, we can get here, but here's some of the things that you're going to have to pay with, right? And here's what you need to understand. Are you willing to do that? I had that client discussion today. And he said, you know, I'd really like to get a little bit leaner in my midsection. I'm like, okay, well, how much more are you willing to sacrifice? Because I've been there, I competed in bodybuilding, and I said, I'd never been more miserable in my entire life. I said, do you want to start weighing and measuring all your food? Do you want to start carrying a cooler bag everywhere you go? Because you can get there. I'm not saying you can't, but are you willing to make that sacrifice? Because that's going to be the trade-off. And is it going to really make a difference in the end of the day? Are you going to walk in the house and people are going to be like, oh my God, you're thank God you got abs, right? Probably not, right? So you got to look at what really matters, and if it doesn't matter enough for you to make that trade-off. Now, if it's how you make your living, if it's what you're going to compete in, and you have to get ready for the show that they're not going to move the date for, and you better be ready because it's going to happen whether you're ready or not. That's that you have to say, okay, well, here's what some of the trade-offs are going to be. Same thing if I'm dealing with somebody who's overcoming any kind of musculoskeletal issue and they got the big game coming up and say, look, you're not 100%, but you're at 90%, and 90% of you is better than 100% of your backup. And so, you know, just understand we're doing the best we can for what we have, but this, you're not totally right. You're not fixed. You're good enough that we can move forward, but you're not really where we want to be. Come off season, we'll get this thing right. So there's just trade-offs that we have to make every single time.
what a fun, that's such a, you know, a good reminder. And like, it's something that I've heard in the past, but obviously in a professional setting, not something I guess thought about nearly as much, you know, like communicating that to my clients of like, yes, we can do this, but what is the trade-off? That's a hell of a fucking reminder. I really appreciate you saying that out loud. That's huge. Are there trade-offs to being in your position? To being a coach and to being at a high level, what are those things that you've made sacrifices for? Or what? Yeah.
Well, you're sacrificing your freedom to do, like when I'm in, if I'm training you at my facility, I have free rein to do what, for the most part, anything I want, once you've bought in that you're going to work with me. Unless there are some of those other players that are coming involved that are part of a quote unquote team that you have to, that you kind of are part of. But other than that, I have pretty much carte blanche for full reins of the decisions that I make. Whereas if I'm part of a team, part of a system, I have to understand my role in that ecosystem, that I'm not here to do maybe this thing or that thing. And so because of that, I have to understand and appreciate that role and understand that this is my piece of it. And so I'm not here and because if not, and I undermine the athletic trainer or I undermine the skill coach, well, then I'm not going to be there that long. So I have to kind of appreciate my piece as this cog in this wheel, and understand that there may be some cogs that are a little sticky in that wheel that I might not like, but that's the trade-off, is if you want to be part of this, you're never going to walk into a situation where all the gears are going absolutely smoothly and to the way that you want and expect them to. So you're gonna have to make that trade-off. Well, do you want to be part of this? Because if you think you're going to, you know, stand on the table and change it, you'll go before the system changes.
That's a hard sacrifice to make, I think. Like, I think that's the benefit of having your own location. But that is a tough sacrifice.
Yeah. And so unless you're in very unique situations, do you very rarely have the autonomy. And even if you do, it takes a lot of time to build that trust. Right. So there's even, especially during COVID and up until the last few years, I was consulting with a lot of different high school programs, and it took years to build the trust of that coach to let me call the shots in terms of your warmups, in terms of your conditioning. Not just I'm going to run, program your lifts, but I'm going to do those things. And I'm also going to make some adjustments possibly to your practice plan, and getting the trust to be able to do that, to say, coach, I know you love running gassers and you think it builds mental toughness. It doesn't. It just doesn't. And look, let's try this. And I have to make sure I have the goods that whatever I put in better keep those kids just as fit, if not more fit than what he had, or now I'm also done. So now with that, once I get the trust that, okay, you know what? We've been doing what Eric said and it's working. I like it and it takes less time. Okay, I trusted him on this. Okay. All right. So now here's what I need you to do. That one day that you like to do conditioning, well, that's the day you're doing your no huddle offense. We don't need to do conditioning. It's covered in there, right? Any more conditioning is just going to run these kids more ragged, and it's going to take away from the next day's practice because this is accumulative. And then getting to understand, okay, I trust that. Let's give it a shot. And you have to kind of earn that over time. That's not, if I came in day one and said, let me see your practice plan. All right, this has to change. This has to change. This has to change. This has to change. No friggin' way. I've been coaching 20 years. All right. There's no way you're changing all that. It's a little bit at a time. I've had teams where I came in and I said, the first week or two, I'm just going to watch your program. I'm just going to watch. I don't want to change anything. I just want to watch and I want to observe. And then eventually they say, well, what do you notice? I say, well, here's some of the big things I notice. Okay. Well, you have no tracking system. I saw the same kid do the same weight for the last 2 weeks. Never went up, never went down. Like, how does that kid ever get better? Like, that goes against the grain of how exercise works. You have no tracking at this. You don't have enough consistency, or you have bad flow to your workout in terms of you have a lot of downtime. You need to maximize your time better, or you could need to group your athletes a little bit differently. And they're like, oh, how would you do that? And that's how I gradually get a little bit of buy-in. I don't go in and just overhaul everything day one, because that does not work. And then over time, you get that trust where it's like, whatever Eric says, we'll let him do. But that took years to build.
How do you get involved with these high schools? And like, what are the best forms of marketing that you find, or that you found? And then which are your favorite? Which are the most effective?
It's not even so much marketing, because if you send them a flyer, the coach is going to throw it out. He gets 20 flyers a week from trainers that are trying to get, because everybody wants to work with athletes. It's again, it's building trust. And sometimes it's a matter of, okay, I work with some kid on the team. That kid now flourishes or changes, right? That kid was a JV backup, and now all of a sudden he's playing for a varsity spot. What happened? Like, what did you do? And then, hey, you know, mom or dad will say, let me introduce you to the coach. Hey, coach, you know, if I can help you at all, let me know. Maybe we'll do, you know, let me come in and watch you observe your workouts and just do kind of that same process I said before. And that's how usually it happens. And then, or if you get to the opportunity to train some kids, you need to show up at the games. It's a lot of like, there is no, I sent out a flyer and I got every high school in town. That's not happening. Those coaches have been doing this a long time. They get an arbitrage of people trying to get at their athletes. They need to trust that, you know, because you get one shot for each season. If a season blows up, you could lose your job. And so I can't just trust anybody because they sent me a flyer. So I need to know that this person has the goods. And so you have to put in a lot of legwork and time. I've stood on a lot of sidelines and I've gone to a lot of games to be there. And when I'm there watching one of my athletes, mom or dad says, oh, I want to introduce you to Joe's mom, or this is Danny's dad. You know, this is who so-and-so has been working with. Oh, I'd love to get him to work. You know, can you help him with his speed or help him with his arm strength? Yes. And then that's how it kind of matriculates over time. It is not this windfall of I have some special funnel or I put on some special social media ad. That doesn't work. It has to be a lot of brick by brick building of trust, because there's a lot of people out there, quite frankly. And so one of the things we actually say in our mentorship is one of the main tenets of our mentorship is to answer the question of why you. Why should I train with you? Right. If I'm an athlete and I got six choices in town, because there's a lot more choices than when I started 25 years ago, when I opened up my facility, just about then, when I opened my facility in a pretty upper middle class area, there was a regular, like, pay a membership, family owned gym. There was one physical therapist, and then it was me doing personal training. And I was the only training facility in town. If you drive down through that same main stretch of road right now, you'll find 5 to 6 personal training centers. You're going to find recovery centers. You're going to find probably 4 different physical therapists, 3 or 4 different chiropractors. You're going to find it's a flooded market. So why you? Why am I going to pick you versus anybody else? You need to distinguish yourself and be able to show that you have the goods. And why do I make that decision? And then when you extrapolate that on a larger scale, I think the stats, when we looked them up, it's about 80% of fitness professionals are doing at least some of their training, if not all, online. Well, now, if I can go choose online, well, now I don't have to just pick from somebody that I'm going to drive to. I can pick from anybody in the world. And why the hell would I train with you when I could pick anybody in the world? I can train with, if I have enough money, I can train with basically anybody. Why would I invest with you? And you have to be able to have the confidence. I used to have this drill that I did with my staff when I owned my facility. So I owned a facility that was my own from 2002 for 12 years until 2015. And when I had my staff, before I moved on to get into more consulting and teaching, when I had my staff, we would do an exercise, and it was called our dream client exercise. And said, all right, if you could pick any one client, if I said, Ben, right now, close your eyes. If there's anybody in the world you would want to train right now, because it would be just, I'd love to be able to get my hands on this person, whatever it is, right? You could probably think in your head a couple people in your mind, right? The next question I ask is, if that person walked in the door right now, are you really the person for them? Can you really, if they walked in the door and said, I'm kind of interested, tell me what you got. Because that's what happened when I started working with the Giants. They said, you got 10 minutes, tell us what you got. And I had to impress a room full of people who'd been in the industry, who'd been doing it, you know, a long time, and they've talked to a lot of people, and I had to impress them that I had some value that they could extract from me. So if that dream client walks in the door, what's their impression going to be? Are you going to be the guy sitting eating tuna out of a Tupperware? You're going to have, you know, your sleeves cut off? Are you going to be on, you know, scrolling social media? Is there equipment and shit all over the gym? Like, and then what is your system? What is your checklist? What is your answer for them? How are you going to go about? What's this process going to look like? And if you don't have all those answers, then there is somebody who will, because I will. And if you want to pay the premium, then I'll do it. And I'll beat you every time. So when I say why you, You have to be able to answer that question for your dream client. If you want that person, you have to be that right now. And so, like, I tell the story, when I first started off, I didn't have NFL teams, or I didn't have professional clients or any of that stuff. You know, I started off at a big box gym, and I got it. I didn't have it wasn't even a job, because technically I think they have to get paid if it's a job. Like, it was an opportunity. The guy who owned this big gym said, yeah, you can come on our training staff. And I'm like, cool. I got certified, came on the training staff, and I was one of 18 trainers, all sharks in the same water trying to get clients. And I said, how am I going to distinguish myself here when there's people that have been doing this for years? So I said, all right, well, let me do this. There's a box at the front desk that if you fill out a slip, you enter it, you put the slip in, you can enter to win a free training session. So I said, like, how does that work? And they said, well, you know, take the leads and you call them. I said, well, who divvies them up? They said, well, nobody really does. And I said, all right, so if I take them, I can call them? And he said, yeah. So I got to the gym. The fact that nobody even asked that, it was astonishing. And then I got to the gym at 5 o'clock every single morning. And I would take all the leads out of the box, and I would wait till 9:01, and I called every single one of them. Congratulations, you won, and you got a free training session with me. And luckily, some of them said, hey, this is kind of good. I'll pay you if you want to keep training me. And that's how I built the clientele. Now, all the other trainers on staff hated me. They're like, it's bullshit. Why do you get all the leads? I said, well, if you meet me there at 5, I'll split them with you. But don't roll in and hang out at the juice bar at 9:30 and think I'm going to give you the sessions. You know, so that's how I built it up. And then I was also realizing that, well, how do clients get here? They have to get sold the membership by one of the salespeople. And sometimes those memberships come with free sessions. So guess what? I'm going to train all the salespeople for free. And and while every other trainer was bitching how they had to do free sessions, this is nonsense, we should get paid, I couldn't wait to do those free sessions. And when I did those sessions, I acted like they were my dream client, because at the time they were anybody who would pay me was my dream client. And so that's how I built my clientele. And that's how I got to be the busiest trainer in the gym within 6 months, when I was surrounded by people who were in the business for years. Is it was just like nobody had the, everybody just sat back and thought clients should just fall in my lap. That's not how it works.
I love that. It's just, that is the grind of being a PT inside of a big box gym. And I think that a lot of people, and I don't, we have a large age range, but we have some younger kiddos that I guess listen to into this as well, as majority between like the ages of 20 and like 35 or 40. For those that do want to get involved in this space at any age, right? There's a lot of people that start in this a little bit later into the game. I think it's doing that little bit of extra and asking those questions and then giving those free sessions. I just was recently at moved states. And so as I moved into this new state, I wanted to just get a quick job and get involved with the community, and giving free sessions to front desk staff, giving free sessions to my own, you know, either trainers or training sessions with trainers. Cause I found it a lot of very, very valuable for me to, either it was an opportunity for me to teach somebody something and hone in on my skills, but at the same time, I could also learn something from somebody else. Like, oh, why'd you pair it like that? Or why'd you choose these exercises? It was fun to be able to like these assessments that you're doing. And so I got to get a lot of value out of it, and hopefully they did as well. But then also it's another, hey, like I was the guy at the gym that was like, hey man, like, can't really I don't really know what's going on with this client. Like, here you go, right? And then it's like, okay, cool. Like, I've built enough trust with my community that I fill a specific role. And then if I'm not suited, I can also find somebody else that's more suited for this specific client than I am, right? It just, it builds a culture that's a lot more, that's less what's famine and more just surplus, right? Everybody can eat. It's just a matter of like, how do we share? How do we grow together?
Yeah, and I have a very similar story, and that's one of the other ways I built up my clients is that I took a different paradigm than most of the other trainers would bitch and moan that, oh, the owner's making us get this certification, the owner's making us get this, and it's like, I already got that certification, I already did 6 other ones. I invested in myself because what I'm selling is my expertise. So the more I know, the more value I have. And so because I had that little bit of extra and I was a couple steps ahead, when the client walked in the door and said to the salesperson, you know, hey, you know, I'd like to work with a trainer, but I have a back issue or a knee issue, or I have this. And immediately every other trainer is like, oh, I'll just give him to Eric because I don't want to deal with that. And I'm like, perfect. I'll be that guy. And so I was that resource just like you were. And it was because I invested in myself. And that's why understanding and appreciating that is like, you can't imagine any other business or industry where you didn't invest into that, into the, whatever that is, right? Restaurants have to invest into their decor. They have to invest into their staff. They have to invest into where they're getting their supplies from. Our investment is what we put between our ears. And if you can't put the money towards that, well, then you shouldn't get that much in return.
I like that a lot. I think it's very fucking honest. It's very straightforward. And that is the reality. It costs money to get better. But at the end of the day, I can charge more because of it, but also my clients can see a better outcome because of the skills and the time that I took to be able to make myself into this better trainer or this better coach.
And you have to also make the decision. Is this your hobby or is this your career? Right. There's a lot of people, the stats show that most fitness professionals are in and out of this business in 6 to 24 months. And it's sad because at some point you were excited. You thought this was going to be your passion. You thought that you're going to be able to change people's lives. And then what happened? You got into a situation where, hey, I thought I can make, you know, $90 an hour times 40 hours a week. I'm going to make six figures. And it's like, well, no, you're not. Like, you don't understand how the mechanics of this works. And we need to teach you how it actually happens. And you allowed yourself to get bumped off course because you weren't that determined, that you just wanted to get kind of, you thought it was a cool idea, but it wasn't, you weren't, you know, like the old Conor McGregor, you know, thing is that I'm not talented. I'm obsessed. Right. And so with me, I had no fucking interest in being mediocre when I was going to do this, that I saw people who were the kings of the industry at the time. And I said, I want to be them. And I remember having these conversations. I just had a great conversation with Alan Cosgrove. And I said, when I first met him, and I said, Alan, I'm going to speak on stage and perform better right with you at some point. And, you know, and it took a little while and I kind of took a circuitous route, but sure enough, this past year I spoke, and ironically during the same time slot he did. Right. And so like, I was determined to do that. And so to do that, I had to, in terms of the investment, if you're the young trainer that's saying, well, it's expensive, these certifications or these mentorships, look, you're going to bet on yourself. Do you trust that it's good, that you're going to be able to deliver? If you had this information, do you have the guts and the courage that you're going to be able to actually fulfill that? Right. Can you see yourself being that person? And I always could. I wanted to be that person the dream client walks in for, and I'm going to be able to deliver. Nobody else is going to be able to deliver it like me. So when I started off, you know, I did mentorships where I laid out my credit cards and I took weeks off of work to go do them. And I invested thousands of dollars I didn't have because the guy I wanted to learn from is doing what I wanted to do. And as much as I took away actual skills that I utilize today, whether it's assessment, whether it's exercise decisions or any of the things I learned from them, what was most important that I took away from those relationships is what I'm trying to convey to you now and to the people that are listening, the coaches and trainers are listening, is what the biggest thing I took away from them was the level of expectations I had for myself. And to this day, every time I do a training session, I act as if all those mentors are in the room watching me, and I need to honor them by saying, I want you to be proud that I'm not only doing what you're doing, but I think I actually are doing it better right now. And that's really where I want to take the approach to that. And so that's what my suggestion would be to anybody. If you really want to be the best, you have to be fully, fully committed to it. And that means you're going to invest in yourself. And that means you're going to have the courage and the commitment that you're going to see it through.
I think that goes for not just coaches and trainers that are listening, but for people in any field that they're in. It is relationships. It is with, you know, if I want to be a good friend, what is my expectation of a good friend? And how do I continue to follow up with that? Like, how do I build good community, build good relationships, be a good husband or wife, be a good father? Like, it is that same concept that I find is a beautiful consistency from people who are successful, that care about their job, that can be transferred into any other field. I remember reading Under the Bar by Elite FTS. What's the guy's name? I'm going to forget.
Ah, man. Dave Tate?
Dave Tate. Thank you. Yeah. So read that when I was in high school, and it was, I hated school so much, but I wanted to lift all the time. I got to start read the NSCA. I don't know if you ever did T Nation, but I did T Nation when I was still in high school. And like, I was going to be the absolute best in the gym and the most educated that I could be, really, at that point, just for me, right? It wasn't, I think I had like a couple clients at that time that were teachers, which is cool, but I was determined to be the best that I possibly could for Ben. And I lost sight of the education piece, and I started to not do well in school, and I was started to drop off in my friends. And it was, all I did was in, I was in the gym till 10 o'clock at night and go to the gym again at 6 o'clock in the morning. And finally, after reading that book, it was like, you're just transferring a skill, man. That's all you're doing. You're just the same passion and love that you have for the gym. You can just transfer that to your academia. You can transfer that to being a good partner, being a good spouse. And I was like, at the time, mind blown. It's like, he's so right. Like, I've already been working so hard. Now I just got, I already know how to work hard. Now I just got to transfer it over a little bit and just work hard over there too. And I think that it fits for this space, but I think part of this podcast is that we're all so similar, no matter the field that we're in. The people that do truly want to be successful have more in common. The language may be different. It may be benches and squats, or it could be P&Ls and standard procedures, right? It could be like, but they're the same fucking thing. And that's what I absolutely love.
Yeah. And that's really why when Mike Perry and I started this kind of mission is we came up with this concept that we're going to teach principles and not methods. There's enough people teaching methods, but we're going to teach you principles because that's really drives it. And you could plug in any method that you want. And so what makes people like a Steve Jobs magical is because of principles that he had, not so much for Phil Knight, people like that. Like the principles that they had, the shoes were the easy part, right? For me, the nuts and bolts of, you know, exercises or any of those things, because that's everybody that just has a pissing match on social media about. But understanding the principles is what drives that level of success. And then what ultimately makes you great versus good is your ability to communicate that, right? And so as much as you need to learn the nuts and bolts of biomechanics and physiology and all of those sorts of things, you also have to understand how to teach. You have to understand how people learn, and you have to learn communication and how it's going to be different from one person to the next, and how you can adapt yourself and morph yourself. If I'm standing in front of a high school girl soccer team versus standing in front of a 45-year-old executive versus the next scenario, I have to learn how to do that and be able to communicate really well and build that trust and rapport. And those are skills that you develop outside of the exercise science world. And we get so wrapped up. And I did this mistake early on, is that I wanted to impress everybody with lots of Latin terms and, you know, teaching all that kind of stuff, and realized when I really got good is when I really got good at that communication piece. And it's like the great line I always think of from John Wooden, who's the greatest coach of all time, arguably, as he said, "And you have not taught unless they have learned," right? Am I really getting good at people to learn, or am I just good at standing there and rattling off things and teaching it as an echo chamber in my own head?
I just went to the NSCA event here in town, a state clinic, and a common trend that I saw with some of these beautiful teachers were the simplicity in which they communicate. It wasn't all of this kind of periodization, and we're going to go through this insertion here to create this. It was none of that shit. It was like, it's more simple than you think it is. Don't over fucking complicate it. Now, how do you communicate to the athlete and then the rest of the team that are for that athlete? And I came away with, I had just met with another guy recently that was throwing all this jargon at me. And I was like, what are you trying to get at here? Like, this is a lot of really cool words, but this doesn't apply. So I don't know what your point is outside of just trying to prove to me that you know more, or that you think you know more than I do. So good job, man. But like, this doesn't teach me anything, versus I think being around this other tier, the really just more experienced coaches, is like, don't worry about all the other bullshit. This is kind of what you need to know. And then, you know, get to understanding how to communicate. And that's,
communication is something that I pride myself, hopefully, on continuing to develop. It's something that I really care about. It's part of the reason for the podcast. I get to see a lot of people from all the way around the world that I can communicate well with and create a story and chat with for over an hour. It's a win all day.
Yeah, 100%. And a lot of times, like you said, it's just an ego stroke. It's, you know, Einstein said, if you can't explain it simply, you don't know it well enough. And so I explain to people, the more I do this and the better I get at it, I have my three favorite answers are number one, maybe, maybe not, right? Number two is it depends. Okay. You know, and then three is, I don't know. Right. And I get more and more comfortable saying that every single time, because that's going to pretty much answer most of those things, because I don't care what you're asking me. If you're asking me about your HRV, or if you're asking, you know, what's the proper way that where I should set my hands in this drill, depends. You know, is this right? Maybe, maybe not. Right. I need more information than just that in a silo.
I like it. I like those three answers quite a bit.
So before we're going to come to a close here shortly, I had a question that I forgot, and that's unfortunate. You said you're going to start switching into a different clientele. What is next for you, Eric?
So, you know, fortunately I've kind of checked the box of being able to work with the pros and, you know, gotten the ring and the jerseys for the wall and gotten that experience and gotten to work at all different levels. And there is, you know, the cool factor of that. But then even when you get to the high school level, it was also incredibly rewarding to know you could impact and change kids' lives at a very vulnerable time, where they can get, you know, talk about that fork in the road and you can steer them in the right direction. If I did nothing else but get them to see that there's more to themselves than what they think, and then get them to believe in that. You know, so all those things are very cool. But the biggest thing that I'm kind of focusing on is a clientele that was coming at me quite, you know, kind of fast and furious over the last couple of years. And I just started to notice this trend. And then I sort of had this epiphany of like, I keep getting the same guy showing up over and over again. That guy is somebody who's usually 40 plus. They're super active, usually a type A type of personality. And they're somebody that they're not coming to me because they need somebody to quote unquote get them to work out. They're already working out on their own. They usually have pretty, you know, intricate home gyms. They just don't know what to do. And they've usually been following the same program that they've been doing since high school, and they keep beating themselves up and they're hurt all the time and they have these nagging aches and pains. And they're also guys that are not ready to like give up and just play pickleball, right? They want to like, these are people who still want to do obstacle course races. They want to play high level tennis or golf or whatever it may be. And they're not ready to go to the rocking chair anytime soon, but they feel broken. They've lost a part of their identity because they can't do the things they want to do. Every time they get on a roll, they start getting these things that pop up. And so I'm like, I keep getting this client. Like there's a lot of it out there. And it's like this perfect storm of these clients keep showing up to me. And then also things that weren't around 25 years ago when I started, like things like Peter Thiel and Andrew Huberman and Rich Roll and these podcasts that are like household names. I got to see Andrew Huberman at the Beacon here in New York, and he sold it out. Like a scientist, a professor from Stanford. So I had to buy him on a secondary market. It was crazy. Like this is like the most encouraging thing. Just when I think America couldn't get any dumber, I'm like, wow, this is encouraging. Like people are going out to see a scientist talk. This is really cool. And you see, you know, people, you know, every time I go to a party, they see a different guy who's wearing a different wearable device and they're talking about, you know, recovery methods, and like they're really getting intrigued in being able to be a beacon for their own, taking care of their own health. And so like this perfect storm of all this is happening. And the ultimate epiphany was realizing like, I'm one of them. Like, I'm 51 and I like, my kids are like, well, why don't you play softball? I'm like, cause that's for women and old and old guys. Like I'm playing, I just started playing 35 and older men's baseball, and I'm not going to be the guy with the knee sleeve and the pinch runner who can't do anything. Like I want to be like, I'm laying out for balls. I'm legging out triples. I'm stealing bases. Like, and the guys on my team are like, doesn't that hurt? Like, how old are you? I'm like, no, I'm an average athlete on my best day. Like, but this is just, if you take care of yourself, you don't have to be resigned to be that. And so that's what I've become passionate about, is working towards that. And I've built an entire program of remote coaching for that. That's built around educating and giving programs that are built for that population, right? That population that you don't need to be doing your high school workout. That's for kids. Like, you need to do a grown-up workout. And you need to learn how to take care of yourself and be an advocate for your own healthcare. And here's all the elements, from mental elements to lifestyle, to how you're going to look at your training and recovery and all these factors, and kind of rebuilding you from scratch. So that's kind of been my biggest passion on the client facing side. And then on the mentoring coaches and kind of paying it forward, because I've had so many great mentors along the way. That's where I teamed up with Mike and said, look, I want to do the same for trainers. I want to be able to take that trainer who wants to be the best. They just don't know how. Cause like you said, they're getting this arbitrage of information, and most of it is quite frankly, it's bullshit. It's guys jumping in your DM saying, I can get you 50 clients in 20 minutes. Right. And it's like, okay, great. You can get 50 clients in 20 minutes, but what happens when you show up and when they all show up and you suck, right? Now you got to get 20 more clients because your service is shitty. So ultimately the business builder is, you're good enough that once they come, they never leave. And now you don't have to keep refilling that bucket all the time. And so we want to teach you to be so good. Like I said, you're the only choice. And then once they come to you, they never going to leave. And I've had clients, the standing clients that I do have, every single one of them has been with me for 10 plus years, some 15 or 20 years. Wow. Like, what's the ROI on that? Right. So I don't have to go fill that bucket. I haven't looked for a new client in as long as I can remember. That's ultimately what, from a business building, that I want to pass on to young trainers, is that's what you want to look for.
That is congratulations, man. That's awesome. That is super neat. I love that. Where can people find you, man?
So there's two places. The main hub is just my website. That's where you can find all my social media. That's where you can find links to kind of all this different stuff. The program for the guys over 40 is not, I'm going to be launching that in the next month or so, but that's called Eterno Athletics. That'll be coming up towards the end of 2023. The other stuff, principles of program design and so forth, that you can get all the links as well as my social media stuff on my website. And then also on the website, what I did, because I do a fair amount of things like this and do a lot of teaching, is that I have a thing on my homepage that I always have up there called Ask Eric. You want to ask me a question, then put it in there and it goes directly to my email, and I'll get back to you within 48 hours, if not with an answer, with a resource to where you can find it. And the reason why I do that is I always was puzzled when I would go out and go to conferences and I'd see speakers speak. And they were kind of clandestine about their contact information or any of that stuff. They just wanted people to get to, you know, they wanted followers and likes. They didn't want to actually interface with the people who were sitting in the crowd. And I said, look, I want you to ask me questions, because I have people. I, as a matter of fact, I actually got a DM today from someone said, oh, I took one of your workshops 2 years ago. I got a question for you. If I made enough of an impact at a workshop you took over a day 2 years ago, then I've done my job. I'm happy to answer your question and take 5 minutes. And you never know what comes of those conversations. You know, we had on my own podcast that we have, that Mike and I do, to kind of support the principles of program design. It's called Principles of Performance. That link you can also find on there. Is those interactions, it's funny, you never know where they lead. We had a great story. We had John Russo on our show. And John tells the story. He goes, you know, before we get started, I got to tell a story. He goes, I was a young kid in PT school. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I sent a message to Eric. And he said, you know, can you help give me some direction? And he said, why don't we just jump on a call? And he said, he spent hours with me on the phone. He said, it completely changed the direction of my career. And the funny thing is, Ben, I don't even remember it. It's horrible to say. I didn't even remember it. And then he's like, yeah, like 15 years ago, we had like a wow, multi-hour phone conversation. And it was like a big influence on my career. And now John has gone on to great success, and I couldn't be more excited for him. And it's like, you know, if I was at that fork in the road for him on the trainer side, and I'm like, dude, there's a lot of possibilities. Here's what you could do. Why don't you do it? And he's now gone and ran with it and gone way beyond whatever I could, you know, I imparted to him. That's a cool thing to have. And like, we, you know, people in our mentorship, I can't wait for somebody and people in our mentorship to blow past us, you know, right? And that's because that's what I want to have. So that's where those interactions are really meaningful for me. And that's why I have that thing on there to ask a question, because I never know who that question is going to come from or where it's going to lead to.
It's beautiful. I got to include something like that as well, because I've had so many people in my life make such a big impact with just having a conversation, like conversations like this. But it's like, I remember sending Facebook messages to the first guy that ever knew about powerlifting outside of the university or outside of high school, and found this guy. He was powerlifting, Preston Turner, and I will love Preston till ever. He's pretty much what the only, but maybe it may have figured it out at some point, but he's the reason that I ended up competing for Team USA. Otherwise, I didn't even know that it was a possibility. So it's just, there's so many good people around that have made me just into a better human, that being that influence for somebody else is significant. It feels good.
Yeah. And you're going to find that most of the people who do what we do got into, when I ask any of them, when I go out and teach, say, why you do what you do? The answer is 99 times out of 100 is because I wanted to help people. And that doesn't go away when you become the big name on stage or you're selling, you know, courses or any of that stuff. There's still that innate need that want to help people. And the great ones are very happy to return the DM or to do, you know, to do the favor or say, hey, look into this and kind of point you in the right direction. And if they don't, you know, oh, well, you know, what's the worst thing that happened? You got an unreturned DM. It didn't cost you anything. You know, yeah. And it's worth a shot. Ask them. I mean, even when we started a podcast, I made a list of 200 names that have, there are people that have influenced me or that are colleagues or that are people that have had an impact on my career. And I just started messaging all of them. And fortunately, I've been able to get some pretty cool ones on the show just because I asked and they were happy to help.
Ask, close mouth, don't get fed.
100%.
All right. Well, Eric, thank you again for the time, man. Anything else you'd like to close off with?
That's it. I would say if you're a young coach or trainer out there and you're looking to kind of level up, you're looking to stand out, is really question, is this what I really have a calling for? Is this what I want to do? Because if not, then it's just an occupation and you're going to be no different than somebody sitting in a cubicle. If you do have a passion for it and you want to be in that top 1%, well, you need to invest in yourself and understand what it is that you're selling. You're not selling exercises. You're selling your ability to impart wisdom that's going to be something that people then can digest and then utilize so they can better themselves. And so the better you get at that, the more your value is.
Cheers. Thank you. Love y'all.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Share the podcast. Go to the website. Do all the things. Love y'all. Take care. Be safe. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Ben Navratos podcast. Check us out on iTunes, Spotify, and all other major podcast hosting platforms. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes.